conservancy.org or find us on social media. KPFT Houston.
Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals Wednesday 8 p.m., and it's time for So What's Your Story? We're the only program originating in Houston devoted to live storytelling, and we're right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. I'm Warren Holloman. Tonight I'll be your host. Each week, Hank, Greg, Mary, and I celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on remarkable tellers who engage us with stirring personal stories as well as treasured traditional folk tales, tellers who show us how stories connect us to our past, give meaning to our present, and give us direction for our future, and tellers who take us on captivating journeys and then return us safely home. And the only reason we are able to actually transmit those stories from the KPFT studio to you, our listeners, is because Tatiana Gago is here to handle the engineering duties, which we deeply appreciate, Tatiana.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. We need you. I'm guessing you have some final exams coming up in a few days.
Yes, I have lost a lot of sleep.
And are these weighing on your mind?
A little bit, yes.
A little bit. And you're in here helping us tonight.
So, always a pleasure.
We deeply appreciate it. For those listeners who tuned in last week, you got a real treat. Alyssa Ladd and Paul Topekian told hilarious stories about on the theme of awkward moments. Alyssa got injured while kissing at a church camp, and Paul accidentally found himself in the women's restroom of the Charlotte airport. Greg hosted, and he also shared a story about his encounters with Barbara Bush, which was kind of awkward too, since Greg is a Democrat. But not that awkward, because the Bush family was so gracious, and I think we could use a little more of that graciousness these days. If you missed the show, you can catch it in many of our past shows on our Facebook page. In fact, I bring this up now to remind you that you can also watch tonight's show on Facebook Live. Just go to the So What's Your Story page. And the amazing stories continue, because tonight's storytellers are also among Houston's finest. Dave Baca was raised on a farm in Cuero on the northern edge of the Rio Grande Valley. He trained as an engineer at Texas A&M, then matriculated to UT Austin to get a master's degree in library science. Then he headed back to A&M for a PhD in educational administration. And he's now at Texas A&M Galveston, where he's director of the library and the Learning Commons. Of course, we know him, and to some extent his family, from his many wonderful stories at the Moth. Dave and his wife Priscilla are about to reach the 29th year of their marriage, and actually Priscilla is joining us in the studio and helping us with the Facebook Live feed. My other guest tonight is also named Dave. It's a little confusing, so I'll try to call him David. David Cole is also a native Texan. He grew up in San Marcos. He told me he somehow tricked his beautiful wife Tricia into settling for him, and now they have two wonderful kids, Reese and Carter. David practices tax law here in Houston. He's a partner with Vincent and Elkins. Unlike the rest of us, David is not a frequent Moth storyteller. In fact, I think he's only been to the Moth once. But he did happen to stand up and tell a story, and 2 weeks ago, it was featured on the Moth Radio Hour. And then there's my third guest, who isn't a guest at all. Hank is here, and he's going to tell a story as well. So, gentlemen, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Thank you, Warren.
Thank you.
Jazz to be here.
Yeah, we're delighted to have you here. We're going to have fun tonight. I'll start with a question for David Cole. What was it like for you to go to the Moth one time and put your name in the bag and stand up and tell a story?
Well, Warren, it was kind of an interesting experience. I must confess, my wife initially was the Moth fan, not me. So I went along as kind of a favor to her, and we get there early because she wants to get a good seat. So we're sitting there, and I tell her, you know, I'm thinking of putting my name in the hat. And she's like, well, what story would you tell? I'm like, well, I would tell the Ben story, which is what I'm going to tell later tonight. She's like, well, you know there's a theme, right? I was like, no, what's the theme? She said, well, the theme tonight is betrayal. I'm like, well, the Ben story is not really about betrayal. So I go up and I ask the guy holding the hat. I was like,
Tony.
So, Tony, how important is it that the story relate to the theme? And Tony says, well, you know, it's helpful if it relates to the theme, but it doesn't always relate to the theme. You know, people just kind of want to hear a good story. So I put my name in the hat. And then, of course, the MC comes on as the show starts. And the first thing she says is, if you get up here, your story better relate to the theme. And Tony, though, has already taken the hat backstage, so my name is stuck in that darn hat, and they keep calling name after name, and I don't get called, and I don't get called, and I think finally I'm off the hook. But, of course, the 12th and final name called was mine, so I got to go up and take some abuse for not being on theme.
Do you have any idea? And then you had the pleasure of your story being played on the Moth Radio Hour a couple of weeks ago. Do you have any idea how many people heard that?
You know, I don't, although I heard from some friends scattered all over the country and other people more local. And I got one anonymous fan who just called and left me a voicemail at work saying
that's so cool.
She enjoyed the story. So I guess I officially have a fan club of one.
That is so cool. Well, we'll talk some more about that. But let me bring Dave Baca in here. Dave, you're a more frequent Moth teller. Why do you tell stories?
Well, I originally got up there was really to just sort of test my confidence and conquer fears without putting myself into some situation that was going to kill me. And it's also about the craft. And I'm in higher education, and we have a writing center. And whether the stories are written or told, I really appreciate how those stories are put together. And it's always a challenge for me to just try to get, you know, something kind of pared down to where
it What is it about stories that draws you to them? And we'll talk more about this near the end of the show, but just a
I think for me it's always that sort of moment of surprise. You know, these stories sometimes kind of start out sort of mundane, and then there's that moment where they switch over, and it's just really kind of a magical sort of moment when that happens.
Oh, it sure is. It sure is. Well, the theme 2 weeks ago at the Moth Monthly Story Slam, not the radio show, was caught. And you told this great story about getting caught committing a very serious crime, which I'm sure was the first step toward a long period of juvenile delinquency. Could you tell that story?
Sure. You know, my parents, I don't know, like all parents, my parents were just actually not very good parents. I was the first kid, and I was kind of a surprise to them, I think. And they didn't really know anything about parenting. They didn't even know the parenting books existed. Yeah. And so they kind of went by instinct, and their instinct was to kind of fall on the strict discipline side rather than the nurturing side. Mm-hmm. So when I was about probably 8 years old, I stole a pack of gum from the grocery store. I don't know why, because eight, right? My mom caught me, and she's like, where did you get this gum from? She knew I didn't have any money to buy any gum. And I was like, because I wasn't really a fast thinker on my feet, right? And my mom just went nuts. She knew the day had finally come when I was going to start my slide into the being a hardcore criminal. So she took action. She marched me back to the grocery store, got me in front of the store manager, made me apologize. It was just sort of this very humiliating sort of experience. And then she took me to the police station, and she talked to the officer there, and they fingerprinted me, which was kind of cool. And then they locked me in one of the jail cells, which I just lost it all. I was just a mess. And I don't know who parents like that, right? This was kind of like tough love before tough love was a thing.
Right.
But that really wasn't even the worst part. What my parents lacked in parenting skills, they made up in psychological warfare. It was the, you know, wait till your dad gets home. And I just begged my mom, please don't tell my dad, please, please, please. And I made all kinds of promises, and she was like, nope. It was that sort of talking to the hand before talking to the hand was invented. And so this was in the morning sometime, and I spent the entire day just in fear of what was going to happen when my dad got home. So I was just this nervous wreck all day. It was all I could think about. So my dad finally gets home. I see him pull up in the driveway, and I just sort of run into my bedroom and hide. And I can hear him talking when my dad comes in. It was like, damn it. You know, he was upset. And my dad kept his belt on some hooks on the inside of the closet door. So every time he opened the door, those belts would kind of sway, and the buckles would kind of click together, and there'd be sort of this tinkling sound. And that's kind of where the spanking belts were, not because there were any special belts, but just so he wouldn't have to take his off and his pants fall down kind of thing. So I was just hoping, please, I don't want to hear any of the tinkling. And of course I heard the tinkling, and all hope of any kind of staying out of trouble just sort of vanished. And I was really, I just kind of turned into this gooey blob on the bed, just sort of curled up in the bed. And my dad comes in, and I do the same thing. So please don't spank me, please. I'm just sort of begging him. I'll never do it again. I'll be a good kid, the whole thing. And he said, you know, turn around and bend over. And it actually wasn't that bad, right? It was just really kind of a relief after it was over with, because it didn't really hurt that much. It was just really that whole psychological thing of doing that all day long. And of course, you know, that wasn't the first time or last time I got in trouble a bunch. But what I did learn, the kind of thing that I took away from this that I can still use today, is I understood that my mom really was the gatekeeper to the punishment, right? Mm-hmm. So I kind of learned how to negotiate with her. And in exchange for her silence, I would, you know, weed the garden or fold clothes, something that benefited her. And it was that win-win before win-win was invented this long ago. And so I learned my lessons. You know, I learned about right and wrong. I learned all the things that you learn about, you know, not lying, not stealing, all the things that make you a good citizen. Although I did see myself last week, I picked up a pen from work, and I don't think I'm going to take it back. So take that, Mom and Dad.
You recalcitrant young man. That's great. So was that a story about a bad kid or a normal kid?
Well, I don't know. I didn't know any kids that didn't do those things, right? It's kind of hard to be good all the time, or at least that's what I tell myself as an adult. I'm not a parent. You know, I don't know how I would have raised my children. I think it's kind of hard to be a good parent. But my parents didn't have any role models. All the kids were, you know, kind of the same, and we all got punished, and I'm not sure how you sort of reason with kids. I don't know the process.
I'm curious to hear David Cole's or Hank's reaction to your story.
I can only be shocked at just how different the world is today from then. I mean, you know, these days, if you call the police department and ask them to help discipline your kid by playing along and, you know, fingerprinting them, they'd want to know, does your kid have any ink allergies and you'd have to sign a release? So I think the days of that kind of, you know, effective punishment are probably long gone.
And I don't know if they still have my prints on file somewhere. I don't know if they actually kept those or not.
Well, I heard Dave's story, as he knows, and I ran up to him and I said, you got to tell the story on the air. I love the story because I'm totally convinced that parents are responsible for criminal behavior. So the idea of you, right, being somewhat of a – I'm exaggerating to make a point, of course. But, you know, bad parents, that's all part of it.
Yeah.
It also makes parents who aren't that great, like me, look a lot better. So that too, was a big part of it. I'm a grandparent, so, you know, that's the easiest part. Because you don't have to be a parent at all. You just have to spoil the kid and say the rest is yours.
Your grandkids are a completely different thing from your kids.
Right, exactly, exactly.
If you're just tuning in, this is So What's Your Story here on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. You can catch us at 89.5 in Galveston, 91.9 in Huntsville, and online at www.kpft.org. Now, my second guest, of course, is David Cole, and David, a number of us heard your wonderful story, Finding Ben, either about 3 or 4 years ago at the Moth or 2 weeks ago on the Moth Radio Hour. And I'm delighted tonight because, of course, with the constrictions of the Moth, you were only able to tell the 5-minute version. Now you're going to tell the whole story.
Well, yes. There's some details I had to omit, so hopefully anyone who's already heard it can get a little something new out of it. So, yes. So, Warren, this happened years ago before my wife and I moved to Houston. We used to live in Austin. And at the time, you know, our kids were 3 and 1, and we had a little, you know, gift exchange routine with some friends of my wife's who lived in Dallas. So around Christmas, we'd send gifts to their kids, and they'd send gifts to our kids. So we get the box from them, and we open it up, and, you know, there's 7 or 8 gifts in it. And we look, and all the gifts are addressed to Ben, Love Grandma. And as you said in the intro, my kids are named Reese and Carter.
Right.
So we thought this was odd, and my wife's friend is not a grandmother. So we called her and said, hey, the gifts you sent, they're addressed to Ben, Love Grandma. And she said, I don't know what you're talking about. The gifts I put in that box were addressed to Reese and Carter. We double-checked the box. It's addressed to us. It's from her. So we now know somewhere along the way from Dallas to Austin, the contents of our box got switched with some other box.
Oh, boy.
So she says, I'll go down to the post office and, you know, figure out what happened. So she goes. Of course, they have no idea. And we just set the gifts aside and really let them sit. And then finally, it's Christmas comes and goes. We're now getting into early February. Valentine's Day is coming up. I'm a pragmatist, so I'm like, well, maybe there's an opportunity here to re-gift something. So I think it's time we open Ben's gifts. So we open them. The first couple are just kind of small, have little trinkets in them. Then we open kind of one of the bigger ones, and it's a teddy bear. And I'm thinking, oh, well, good. This is something we can re-gift. but, of course, my wife has a much different attitude. After every present, she's like, oh, poor Ben. Poor Ben's not getting his teddy bear. And I'm kind of thinking to myself, okay, well, yes, I feel bad for Ben, but at least we're getting something. So then we open the next present, and it's a pair of pajamas for a 5-year-old boy. My son is 1, so I'm like, well, at least 4 years from now, we can use these pajamas. And again, my wife is like, oh, poor Ben, he doesn't get his pajamas. So then we open now the second to last gift, and it's a beautiful sweater. And I'm kind of admiring it, thinking, well, at least someday my son can wear the sweater. My wife goes, oh, there's no tag on the sweater. I'm like, okay, help me understand what that means. She's like, this is a hand-knit sweater. Grandma knit this sweater for Ben. And now I'm thinking, well, that's really unfortunate, but I'm glad we'll get to enjoy it. And then we open the final, the biggest present, and it's this old quilt with like a race car design on it. And then attached to the quilt is a note that says, Dear Ben, this is a present that Grandma has sent especially for you. This car was on your daddy's bed when he was a little boy just like you. It is for you now. With love, Grandma. So now we both look at each other and like, we have to find Ben. But the only names we have to go by are Ben and Grandma, which really doesn't get you too far. So we start combing over the gifts, and the best clue we can find on one of the little trinkets, there's a little sticker that says Spring Hill Hospice. So I scour the internet and cannot find a Spring Hill Hospice, but I did find the closest thing I could get was a Spring Hill Day Hospice. But it's in England. And again, this was a box sent to us from Dallas to Houston. So I kind of conclude, well, that can't be it. But then my wife is going through and she looks, the brand on the pajamas, she's saying, I don't recognize this brand. So we look it up and sure enough, it's an English department store brand. So we're thinking that maybe there is something now to this English connection. So I call the Spring Hill Day Hospice and, you know, leave some voicemails and kind of get the runaround and nothing happens. And I find some email addresses on their website and I send a bunch of emails and either don't get responses or no, everyone is like, I don't know Ben and I don't know Grandma. You know, good luck with that. So that turns into a dead end. So I check and it turns out the specific town that the Spring Hill Hospice is in is a town called Rochdale in England, which is only about 20,000 people. So I look, and sure enough, they have a small local paper, the Rochdale Observer. So I call them, again, kind of same exercise, you know, voicemails not returned, kind of the runaround. Then I find a few email addresses for editors, email them, again, no response. Finally, the last email address I can find is for the online reporter. And she says, oh, this is interesting. I'll put your story up on the website. So she does. You know, I keep checking in, any response, nothing. So then I ask her, I was like, well, is there any way you could get this in the print edition? And she's like, well, I know one of the print reporters. She owes me a favor, so let me see what I can do. And so finally, on March 15th, we get the story to run in the print version of the paper. And now, if that was the end of the story, it really wouldn't be that great a story. So as you can probably imagine, there's another story here. And this is a story about an Englishman named Chris. So Chris grew up in, you might guess, Rochdale, England. Chris grows up. He's got one sibling, a sister. Chris, you know, graduates from college, gets married. Chris has a son. He and his wife have a son. Their son's name is, guessed it, Ben. So Chris takes a job in London for an American semiconductor company. And after a couple of years, they give him an offer to move to the States, specifically to Austin. At the time, Chris has some reluctance to leave England because his mom has been diagnosed with cancer and she's not doing well. But his sister's still there in England, so he figures it's really a move he should make. So they move to Austin. And then, you know, he gets a call from his sister getting close to Christmas time saying, hey, we're going to send you three boxes of Christmas gifts. Two of them have, you know, gifts that Mom and I bought for you and your family. And then one box has a bunch of stuff that Grandma really wants Ben to have. So Chris gets two of the three boxes. And, of course, the missing box is the one that had all the sentimental gifts in it. So he's beside himself. He's doing what he can with the U.S. Post Office. His sister's back in England doing what she can with the English Postal Service. And then on December 23rd, Chris gets a call, sees it's his sister calling. So he answers, hoping to hear good news about the box and the missing presents. And she says, Chris, Mom died this morning. So Chris has to put his family on a plane. They fly back to England to go bury his mother. The funeral service is a small one. It's just really family and one family friend who happened to be the only one who still lived in the town of Rochdale. And after the service, Chris is telling his uncle about these missing gifts and how these were things that Grandma really wanted Ben to have, like this hand-knit sweater. It was actually the last thing she was able to knit before she got too sick. Yeah. And the bedspread that she had saved for three decades, waiting and hoping that she would have a grandson to give it to one day. And Chris didn't realize it, but his mom's friend happened to be standing in earshot while he was telling his uncle the story. And she was an elderly woman. Her eyesight was failing. And although she subscribed to the Rochdale Observer, she had pretty much given up reading it. But as luck would have it, some 3 months later, on March 15th, she would do something she rarely did and pick up and read the evening paper. And so she saw the story. She reached out to Chris's sister, kind of told him about it. Chris's sister called the reporter. The reporter was able to connect me and Chris. He turns out he lived about 10 miles down the road. So Chris comes over and brings Ben with him, and we show him the gifts. And, I mean, Chris is just so overwhelmed. For 3 months now, he thought all this was lost. So, you know, he starts crying. My wife and I start crying, and he brings Ben over, and he's so excited to show Ben all these gifts and just how meaningful they are. And sweet little Ben could care less about a bunch of a sweater and an old blanket. He was much more interested in my daughter's Elmo doll than any of these presents.
I got to ask, has there been any communication with Chris and Ben since then?
You know, there has. So after we had them over, they were so sweet, and they invited us over for dinner at their house and gave us this, like, Waterford kind of flower set. It was really nice. We still have it. And we had dinner with them out on their out in their backyard, and they had a swimming pool. At this time, my daughter was three, and she's walking around while we're eating, and they're very nervous about her around the pool. And I'm like, no, she's fine. She's not going to fall or jump in. And sure enough, during dinners, my daughter decides to jump into the deep end. So I get to dive into the pool fully clothed and rescue her. So I don't know that we made the best impression with them. But and since then, we've exchanged Christmas cards with them every year. And then when the story was on the National Moth broadcast, we told Chris, and he listened to it, said it made him cry all over again. Aww. So, yes.
I think one of the things I like about your story is that it says something about good deeds, that we don't always know the ramifications or the consequences. And sometimes they seem so small, but sometimes later we learn that they had bigger implications than we ever imagined.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in reality, everything I did was just a little internet searching and a bunch of emails and phone calls, so it was really... on my end, a pretty small thing, but for him, it was very meaningful. And with that and a lot of luck, we were able to connect.
I mean, it started as kind of a minor annoyance almost, and then it went to your wife, who said, well, we still need to do something about this. Then you started getting more gifts that seemed to be more meaningful. And then you just pursued this. But you still had no idea that it was going to be that timely. A gift.
Yeah, and certainly with Chris losing his mom, right around the time all this was happening, I think it just made it that much more meaningful for him.
That's what I'm saying. And one day I think Ben will appreciate
that. I hope so.
In the blank. Hank, Dave, any thoughts?
Oh, just a great story about generosity of heart and time. Just a wonderful story about generosity.
And this is nuts, right?
Yeah.
All these little bitty pieces all have to fall into place or none of this happens. You've just got to, somebody's got to read the newspaper and just happen to catch that story and then happen to be at the funeral and happen to know this person.
And to be eavesdropping.
Yeah. if any of those pieces aren't there, this doesn't happen.
Absolutely.
It's just nuts.
Well, the fact that we had to go all the way to England to make a connection, which was really just a couple miles down the road, is kind of crazy.
It shows how international the world is and how international Texas is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Pretty remarkable. What would you like our listeners to take from the story?
As we were talking, little things to you can actually mean a lot to others. And then, just perseverance, just keep at it. And, at some point, just hope that the stars align and things will go your way. But if you quit, that's not going to happen.
And you're going to have these connections for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
It really is. Yeah. It really is. We're going to take a little break now, and we're going to check in with Tatiana about our calendar, our sponsors, and next week's show.
Of course. And as always, a big thank you to our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, for all they do to promote the art and craft of storytelling, not the least of which is that they post all our shows from the last 10 years on their website, www.houstonstorytellers.org. Click on the radio program tab and you'll see the menu of all of our shows. And a reminder that the Guild meets the fourth Tuesday of every month at Temple Emmanuel at 1500 Sunset for a story swap. You can come and just enjoy the stories, or you can tell a story of your own. And if you wish, they'll give you feedback, things they like, and things they think might make the story just a bit better. It's a small, friendly group, so the feedback is always easy to take, and as always, very helpful.
And Hank was actually there last night.
I was, and we had 27 people.
Lord.
We had a big group, and there were about a half a dozen from a storytelling class at HBU. Who's always there. And they were pretty wonderful. There were some very, very good stories last night. It really is one of the best-kept secrets in town. The Storytellers Guild is one of the oldest organized storyteller groups in the state and really one of the most reputable. And speaking, if I may, about plugs, we sometimes don't talk about one of the best-kept secrets in town, and that is the independent bookstores. Mm-hmm. Our friend Ben Raybeck from Brazos Bookstore has been on several times, mm-hmm. and they have a magnificent program of of local authors that have written some pretty magnificent stories, and they have a really full slate this summer. And also,
I think that's where I met you when you had your reading.
That's what you met me, right?
About 5 years ago.
And because of you and other people who bought it, I think that my book became a bestseller probably in hours. I think that probably was the case. Also, Kate Williams for Bloomsday Literary, which is a new independent press in Houston, is promoting local poet David Broom, who speaks very poignantly about his life and lives lost during his time in Vietnam. And his book signing is going to be this Saturday, April 28th at 3 o'clock at River Oaks Bookstore. He has a whole new collection out, and I really think it's important for us to, in our quest to learn more about storytelling, to really support some of our local authors and poets, which are pretty magnificent. Now, next Wednesday, in honor of Exam Week, as you so articulately phrased it, Warren, we've got an all-student show. We've got a mixed bag. I've got four students who'll be telling stories, and Tatiana will be one of them. And it's also going to be hosted by students. We've never done that before, but I am not wanting to miss the Grand Slam because you and Greg and a lot of our friends are going to be telling stories at the Grand Slam. I don't want to miss it. And anybody who loves stories won't want to do that either. It's next Wednesday, and it's going to be held at a new venue, the Resilience Theater, in the George R. Brown Convention Center. Again, Greg and Warren will be telling stories along with a lot of our friends. And the theme is, what's love got to do with it? Tina Turner won't be there to sing it. But nevertheless, that is the theme. Should be fun.
Many of our friends on the show, they've been on the show, will be there.
Absolutely.
I think
yes.
Mark Trias, Alyssa Ladd, Paul Topikian, and I'm sure. Yeah.
And we wanted to broadcast originally. We wanted to broadcast this show, but we would just get in the way. So students are going to be here next week, and it will be a great show. Their names are Cam Living and Alejandro Soto. They're both terrific students of mine working radio at UHD. So should be a good program.
Great. Thank you, Hank. Well, I'm back with our guest storytellers, Dave Baca and David Cole. And now Dave Baca has another story that goes back to his childhood days. And it's about his experiences growing up out in the country. I had trouble growing out up in the country or up out. Sorry about that. And like his first story, I think it involves some more of that behavior.
Yeah, I wish it was as heartwarming as that story. You know, part of the parenting thing, I think, was because I was raised on a farm in a small town, and it was just kind of that farm life. And farms are just really, they're dangerous places, so you can understand how my parents might be that way. But there's machinery out there, there's chemicals out there, there's animals, all kind of things you can get in trouble with. Mm-hmm. My brother Brian and I had kind of an ingenious way of dealing with all those things that were like, hurt, maim, or kill you, is we'd get our brother Brad to do it. and so he was just kind of this dumb kid that would kind of always, you know, ask anything you ask of him. And so he'd get hurt so we wouldn't have to, right? You may have seen that old commercial, cereal commercial, where those three kids are sitting at the table, and the two older brothers are looking at this new cereal, and they're just scared of it, right? And they're like, I'm not going to try it. You try it. I'm not going to try it. You try it. Hey, let's get Mikey to try it, right? So that was me and Brian, pretty much. And probably the defining moment of this sort of dysfunctional relationship was in the early 70s. There was a movie that came out that was about Evel Knievel. He was a motorcycle daredevil that would jump his motorcycle over just about anything, cars and buses, and he even tried jumping a river at one point. And his most famous one that it actually got filmed was a jump that he did at Caesar's Palace, jumping over a whole bunch of cars. And it was just this spectacular disaster. They filmed it. It was kind of in slow motion, and you could see him hitting the ramp, and then he tumbles over. And I think he broke just about every bone in his body then. And it was all in this kind of slow motion. It was just wonderful. But he sort of became an American hero for this disaster that he did. And the movie had George Hamilton in it, sort of pre-tan, and it was just a really bad movie. But my brothers and I went to go see it, and we thought it was the best movie we'd ever seen. We had a motorcycle. We had these country roads that we could just, you know, tear up and down. And best of all, we had like this 15-foot hill that was out in the middle of the pasture. So we get home, and we immediately jump on the motorcycle, and we're tearing down the roads and popping wheelies and all this kind of stuff. And when Brad was riding, Brian and I ran to the top of that 15-foot hill to kind of gauge how our Caesar's Palace jump was going to be. And we get to the top, and it was like, no, this thing is really tall. Somebody's going to get hurt jumping off of this hill. Let's get Brad to do it. And, of course, he said yes, right, because he's just an idiot. And so Brian and I run to the bottom of the hill to sort of wait for what we know is just going to be this horrible crash. And we heard him revving the bike up on the other side of the hill. And says, And we can hear him coming up the hill. And then all of a sudden, there he was. He was just on the bike flying off the top of the hill, just like the movie, right? And it was kind of this slow motion thing. He's coming through. It was beautiful, right? It was just like it was supposed to be. And he went really high and really far. And so Brian and I are kind of hunched down at the bottom of the hill because we just know this is going to be horrible. And he lands it. He comes down off the hill and he lands on the motorcycle and he bounces around a little bit, but he stays on the motorcycle. And we just go nuts. We're like, yeah! And we go running around, and we run over towards him, and he just takes off. He didn't even wait for us to get over there. He just takes off, and he rides back to the house. And in a couple of minutes, my mom comes tearing up the road in the station wagon, and we look in, and we can see him in the passenger seat, and his face is just covered in blood. And he had hit the handlebars when he came down and he was bouncing around. He had hit the handlebars and it hit his chin and teeth and stuff. And we thought, we've just killed our brother. You know, she's running him to the hospital and he's not going to make it. So we just really kind of knew we were going to be in trouble. And then he got home. He lived. Yay. He had, you know, stitches and bandages and all that kind of stuff. And, of course, we all got grounded for just being stupid kids. But what happened that day was really Brad was kind of our hero after that, right? And he still kind of is. I mean, that day was really sort of what changed that relationship for us. And Brian and I never jumped off that hill. We weren't brave enough or stupid enough to jump off that hill. But Brad went on as an adult. He flew on P-3 spy planes for the Navy.
Wow!
Right. So it turns out he wasn't a dumb kid. He was just fearless. Right. He would do anything that you ask him. And so he kind of grew up to be one of these people that I really admire. I mean, how he turned out was just so different than how we grew up. But I think really that kind of day sort of changed, you know, my respect for him and what he accomplished. Although recently we were all together and Brian and I were working on some wiring in Brian's house and it was real complicated and we couldn't figure it out. And we needed somebody to find out where the hot wire was. The first thing we thought of, hey, Brad, you know, get over here.
Oh, that story, it's not your problem, but that story was so painful to me. I'm a little brother. So I was taking a different point of view in that story. And that's part of why I liked it and the other story you told. It sort of challenges you to take a point of view. Yeah. And how you hear that story will depend on that.
I had after I first told that, I had a lot of little siblings come up to me and they were like, yep, that was my family.
What's it like for you to go back to those childhood days and tell these stories? I imagine three brothers on a farm, as you said, a lot of danger lurking. Well, and you all survived.
We all survived, yes. I mean, I kind of try to come off as, you know, sort of erudite and sophisticated and cosmopolitan, but my life is really, you know, that farm really had a lot to do with with how I turned out. And I don't know, I haven't told Brad about sort of the way I think about him because of that. I may feel bad that we treated him like that, but probably not any different than any other brother. And it was kind of unexpected. After I told that story, I had a guy come up to me that was in the Navy that had worked on those spy planes. And there's only a couple of places where they fly out of. And it turns out that he was working on the planes in the same outfit as my brother was. He didn't know him. But we were talking about the kind of people that go up in those planes and what they do. And just kind of how brave they are to be doing that kind of thing. And that's Brad. I mean, that really defined him.
I have terrible memories of a farm. And I used to love a farm. However, growing up as a kid, I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, and we used to go out to farms for field trips. And I always had to carry a note which accompanied my asthma spray and nose drops. And it was a total embarrassment. It really was. I mean, you guys ever do insect collections in junior high? Did you ever do that?
Yeah.
My grandmother went out and bought an insect collection from a local hobby shop, okay, because wouldn't let me go out in the woods thinking I might have an asthma attack. It was just really a very embarrassing life growing up.
Well, yes. I hope you got an A on that project.
Oh, I sure did. Yes.
But it is surprising sometimes that we are still all alive. And we all have our fingers and hands and toes. Right.
Well, Dave, as a younger sibling in my family, I would say if there was justice in the universe, I was hoping Brad was going to land on you and your brother. The ultimate payback.
Now that would have been justice, right?
Well, this is So What's Your Story on Pacifica 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. This is Warren Holloman. I'm here with Dave Baca, David Cole, and my partner in crime, Hank Rubicek. And Hank has a story to tell about, I think it's about how to behave, at least in a job interview.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like that. I think it has more to do with ego and pride, but it's almost embarrassing to tell the story after listening to these fabulous ones all night. But this story is about 5.5 minutes long, and I know that because I suffer from obsessive compulsive behavior and therefore I'm flawless. So I know how long this is. Now I do suffer from OCD. People who know me know that. And sometimes that's good. Sometimes it's rather debilitating, but it's not my fault. You know, I was raised in a home with my grandparents, and they were Holocaust survivors, which meant that everything mattered a lot. For example, we had a large rug under our dining room table. And while we were eating, while the large family was eating dinner, my grandmother would take a rake and rake the fringes to make sure they were even. So I was raised in that kind of a home, to put OCD with a period right at the end. Now, my grandfather was much better. My grandfather was a person who was really more concerned about care and about pride. He worked at a paint warehouse, a warehouse where, frankly, mostly teenagers worked, but he couldn't get anything else when he came to this country. And he put paint on a pallet, those big wooden pallets, and then loaded it on the truck. I worked with him several summers. It was a place called Tempo Products in Solon, Ohio. And I used to watch him because I was amazed at how he did his job. It was a menial job. I mean, he put paint on a pallet, and yet it was done meticulously. It was symmetrical. And I would ask him, Grandpa, why are you caring so much about this paint on this pallet? And he would smile and say, because it's my job. That's what he said. And he had Parkinson's disease, and he would shake. And I used to really get angry because some of the kids who worked there, and they were all kids, would call him Shaken Jake because his first name was Jake. And, you know, I used to get so angry, and he would say to me, it's okay, because he was a very gentle man, and every word mattered. Well, you know, this idea of being very meticulous is what I took with me. And when I was in high school, actually from 9th through 11th grade, I had a severe stuttering problem. So I don't take this work on radio or teaching communication for 41 years for granted. I had a severe stuttering problem. I couldn't articulate certain consonants clearly. So I used to do, you know, pa-pa-pa-pa-pa-pa, so you couldn't tell if it was a B or a P. I never raised my hand in class, because by the time I'd get it out, it'd be time for summer break. Or my friends would laugh at me. Either one would be a bad outcome. So my grandfather was the one who told me that you should go through speech therapy. Everybody else said, it'll go away, you know. But my grandfather said, no, you should work on that. And I believed him. I trusted him. I loved him. So I went through speech therapy. And what was required is that every morning for 15 minutes, every morning, I had to look in, I had to stare at the bathroom mirror and very clearly use my speech tools to form these sounds. So I'd have to do buh, 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 making sure that my lips protruded inwards, or puh, puh, making that pucker sound. And I had to do it very slowly. And eventually, I became much better at diction. Well, I graduate from high school, and I go to college at Ohio State, and there was an opening for an internship. Tatiana, you'll be interested in this, at a radio station, WOSU. And it was for a disc jockey for a hard rock show from midnight to 6, 3 days a week. I really wanted it. But my voice, you know, I was really concerned. And there was an audition. So I was determined to go in there and be rewarded for my voice for the first time in my life. I was also told that you could bring in various tools, whatever that might be, because you were having an audition, so whatever you needed to help would be fine. And I said, you know, what will really help me if I brought in a mirror to really articulate these tongue twisters I knew they were going to give me. But I decided not to. And then I thought, you know what, I got to swallow my pride. I don't care if I'm going in there with the mirror. It's going to look ridiculous, but I'm going to do it because my grandfather taught me to be meticulous. He taught me to care. And frankly, his greatest piece of advice was, take my advice and don't take anybody else's advice. Don't listen to other people. So I went into this audition with two things, a mirror and a beanbag ashtray, because everybody smoked. So I had my cigarettes and I had a very strange looking mirror. And the person there, a professor, said, okay, I'm going to give you some tongue twisters, and what I want you to do is to articulate them as clearly as you can. And the first one was, Big Bad Bill bought Bull Baba beer. And I'm thinking, holy shit, God almighty, that's a hell. And I said to him, I'm going to have to look in the mirror, so you're going to have to bear with me. He said, you're going to what? I said, I'm going to look in a mirror. A mirror. Yes, I'm going to look in a mirror. So I looked in a mirror, and, you know, I'm smoking a cigarette, looking in the mirror, really sweating up a storm, nervous as hell. And I said, and I very slowly went, Big Bad Bill bought Bull Baba beer, very articulately. And he looked at me, and I don't know what he meant by this, but he said, that was astonishing. And I didn't quite know what that meant. And I continued on. And then he said, you know, fuzzy, fairy, fuzzy. And I said, oh, my God, the F's and V's, another problem spot for me. Fuzzy, fairy, fuzzy. And I went on, and he liked me, and he said, you're really good, and you got this internship. And I remember my friends after this audition saying to me, your grandfather really came through, right? I mean, he was the one who taught you how to get this internship. And I said, well, actually, I did it with smoke and mirrors.
Oh, that was wonderful. Tatiana, can you hear me in there?
Yes, I can. Loud and clear.
I noticed you were listening to that story about a radio internship.
Yes, it caught my attention.
Told by your mentor.
Yes, yes. Something maybe I would like to consider doing.
I don't recommend that you, you could bring the mirror. I don't know about the smoke part.
Everybody smoked. If you didn't smoke, you really couldn't get the job. It's like, for your cigarettes, you know. And it was a hard rock show. And I really wanted it.
Yeah.
Because I was kind of wimpy looking, and I thought, this is a way to get a date. You know what I mean? Yeah. This is a way to get a date. Now, no one knows what I look like, but who cares? I can sound good, right? That mysterious thing. But, yeah, it was a lot of fun. And my grandfather, and you know, Warren, I tell a lot of stories about my grandfather. My grandparents really were pretty magnificent people. My father was not a bad man, but he was a sick man. He left the house when I was 14. So my grandfather really, really meant so much to me, and I never told him as much as I should have in my life. And I regret that. I do. But, you know, I tell stories about him now, and they're really cool stories because the memories are always so rich. You know, I think about his dialogue. And he was a man of very few words, but really every word meant something. So, you know, he taught me to be caring, and he taught me to be pride-fueled. And I remember when I went in for that audition, I thought, you know, I don't want to embarrass myself. I'm going to go in there with, you know, no mirror. I'm going to go in there. And I think it was my ego that said, you know, I can't let my ego get in the way. It can't restrict me. I've got to walk in there and look weird. I don't care. Because looking weird is what helped me get to that point. I didn't have a whole lot of confidence. So it really was a...
It's amazing that your grandfather had the wherewithal at that time to kind of...
Honest to God, yeah, he did. You know, my grandmother was great. She was great, but she was the aggressor. You know, she was the person you didn't want to mess with at all. You know, but my grandfather was a very gentle person who was thoughtful and said, you know, this is what you have to do. Yeah. Don't listen to anybody else. Forget him. Don't listen to Grammy. She doesn't, you know. Which brings me to another very quick 10-second story. And this is very true and so funny. You couldn't write this. A comedian couldn't write this. When he was dying, a couple days before he died, my grandmother would say to him, Yankel was his Yiddish name. I'm sorry about everything that I've said to you, and I'm sorry about anything that I might have said that upset you, and it goes on and on. And he says to her, "Don't worry, I never listened." And it was just, you know, you just couldn't pay for it. It was right out of Seinfeld.
Yeah. Oh my. I guess, I mean, your grandfather, I would say that's a story about courage, because it takes a lot of courage to go into an interview with a mirror.
Yeah, it does. It does, you know, and I knew it wasn't television, thank God, but it did take a lot of courage. But he taught me courage. He did. He taught me what I think he taught me more than anything else, and he taught me a lot, is to really have a great deal of confidence in your instinct. You know, he always thought that I was a good judge of people. He always thought that I was I knew what to do, that I had a good head on my shoulders, that I was polite, and I was, you know, all the things that I guess you want your kids to do. And he always told me to trust that. He said, always trust that.
Well, what's amazing is you had the wherewithal to listen to him. I think usually that falls on deaf
that's
ears.
True, and that's a good point, Dave, because I didn't listen to a lot of people. I did not. But I did listen to him. I did listen to him, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah. Well, Hank, I find it ironic that you said it was ego that caused you to take the mirror in to the interview. I think most of us would think it would be ego that would want you to keep it out.
Well, that's the thing. I didn't let my ego. I did not let my ego because I did want to walk in and, you know, just do it on my own. But I knew I needed that. I knew I needed that crutch. And I didn't want my ego to get into the way. I knew that I might have to go through this embarrassment. I knew that I have to go through maybe some explanation. Turned out I didn't have to do any of that. He thought it was kind of funny. That's pretty astonishing. You know, and he thought it was funny, entertaining. But I didn't want to go through the embarrassment. I didn't want to go through the explanation. I thought if I explained this, he may not want me to audition at all. He would just see me as a person who was just too weird, too unskilled, too insecure to do it. And it was just sort of disaster fantasy. I imagined all of that. It didn't happen, but we're kids, right? And when you're kids, when you're 18 years old, and that's what I was, I don't know. I just it was a tough call, but I'm glad I did it.
And thanks to your grandfather, you're now a professor of communication.
How about that?
Well, that's to hear you on the 41 radio.
41 years. 41 years, yeah. I'm retiring this year, so somebody will have to.
You've almost got it down now.
Almost got it down, I think, yeah. Yeah, I think I'll keep the job.
Well, Hank, to hear you on the radio now, it's hard to imagine that there was ever any doubt that you wouldn't excel.
Well, I appreciate that. I do. But, you know, I never take it for granted. And Tatiana knows this, and Nicole in particular, because she was in a public speaking class, I never take it for granted. I tell students all the time, my friends too, that, you know, if you can't say it and you can't write it, you might as well keep it to yourself because nothing else matters. You have to make your points clear, and you have to be understandable. And you have to make sense out of the world. And don't say anything until it's clear in your mind, because if you do, it'll never be clear in the mind of those who are supposed to listen. So I never take it for granted. I don't. I never take it for granted. You know, if I get a good evaluation or if I get a compliment about anything that I might do that requires an oral skill, I'm very grateful for that. I never take it for granted.
I bet there's somebody that's going to go out tomorrow and buy themselves a mirror.
Well, you have to look at me.
So we've only got a couple of minutes left. I do want to use this time to ask the two Davids about storytelling and their professional life. I know one of you is an educator and administrator. The other is an attorney. Does storytelling, narrative, hearing stories, do those make a difference in your work?
Well, Warren, you know, again, I'm the attorney, I guess. So, and actually, I do tax law, and we do tax litigation. So, talk about a dry subject matter when you're litigating, you know, hyper technical tax issues. But you know, litigation is about persuasion. It's about trying to convince someone that obviously you're in the right and the other is in the wrong, and if someone isn't paying attention to you, you're not going to be able to persuade them. So absolutely, storytelling is a big part of that. And it's trying to make something interesting because you got to get and keep someone's attention.
Keep the jury awake.
Yeah. In education, we use it all the time. I mean, we have to really talk about our successes and challenges and how to get those kinds of things across to people. I've incorporated it into classes. I use it in professional organizations. I bring in workshops, storytelling workshops. I mean, it really helps you in every aspect of your life.
Do you find the students resonate with that and the juries, or are they more, quote, data-driven?
tax trials are almost always before a judge because there's not a chance you're going to get a jury to really pay attention to these issues. But you'd be amazed how much emotion comes into the decision-making process.
Yeah. But, well, I mean, it has to be sequenced. There has to be a story. You know, it just has. I used to work with cops all the time, and when they interrogated, I mean, you heard voices, didn't you? Didn't you hear voices? Sure, that's what they did.
And I did a guest lecture in a class the other day, and then actually had a few of the students come with me to the Moth. And they just loved it. I mean, they were just so into it.
Well, I wish we could go on and on, but we're out of time. So David, Hank, thank you. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've shared stories about your behavior, some good, maybe not so good. Stories with curiosity, intrigue, surprise, humor, wisdom. Stories that connected generations and some stories that threatened to disconnect them. Stories about the past that help shape who we are in the present. And I'd say stories about relationships and values and things that matter most. Don't you dare move, because Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger are waiting in the wings to share their cool classics. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Warren Holloman and the entire So What's Your Story team reminding you that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Thousands of you have heeded the call, but there's always room for more. You can find KPFT on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. From our latest updates to funny videos, contests, news, and more, you can find us anytime, day or night. We're at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We'd love to give you the latest. Plus, you're already on Facebook. Why not get behind the scenes of Houston's leader for independent music, arts, ideas, and culture right now? Again, find us at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. See you there.
You're listening to KPFT Houston.